Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Our speaker tonight is Dr. Neil Shorenstein from Everyday Zen. I'll let Neil introduce himself and begin his talk.
Good evening.
Good evening.
What a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the kind invitation to come and visit with you today. I was treated to some wonderful Sichuan food this evening. It's one of my favorite cuisines, having volunteered in Tibet with Seva Foundation for some years. We had some mapo tofu and gung pao jiding, and it gave me the energy to be able to speak to you tonight. So I'm very grateful for that. I'm with a group of priests in training in the Everyday Zen Sangha. We're located in the Bay Area. And lately we've been reading Ehe Dogen's Bendoa, or Talk on Pursuing the Way. We covered a passage of it last week that just really got me excited, and I wanted to explore that with you tonight. Dogen wrote Bendoa after his return from China. Dogen left Japan for China in 1223, having failed to find a teacher in Japan who could help him address his great doubt about original enlightenment. The conundrum of original enlightenment is, at least as I understand it, that if we are all Buddhas, which is really one of the major tenets of Mahayana Buddhism, then why do we need to bother with practice in the first place? According to Stephen Hine, in his excellent book, Dogen, Japan's Original Zen Teacher, Dogen, along with his mentor Myozen, could not find the solution to the original enlightenment problem in Japan, and so they left for China to seek the answer. Their travels led them to the great master Rujing, whose core practice consisted of sitting zazen. Rujing eschewed getting too absorbed in incense, bowing, chanting, scripture study, and so forth, and really focused his mind on dropping away of body and mind in zazen. Dogen quickly realized that the wholehearted devotion and practice of zazen was the primary Dharma gate for him. And on his return to Japan, he was convinced that zazen was the practice that is the essence of life and living itself, and is the true connector to all Buddhas and ancestors. He first enthusiastically wrote about this in his first great writing, The Universal Recommendation of Zazen, or Fukan Zazengi. And then he expounded his thoughts more soon after in the Bendoa. Fukan Zazengi was written in carefully crafted formal Chinese. In it, Dogen asks us, implores us, to stop practicing based on intellectual understanding. He describes in detail the technical specifications and ergonomics of seated meditation, how to settle the mind and let go of discursive thinking, and to fully appreciate the awareness of living in our body right here and now. Bendawa, also translated as On the Endeavor of the Way, was written in the vernacular Japanese language, used to give informal Buddhist talks. It's much more approachable, in my opinion. In it, extolling the virtues of Zazen again is the primary subject. But instead of focusing on the details and techniques of Zazen, he gives us an idea of the incredibly expansive effects of the practice. I mean, you can tell how jazzed he was about this seemingly simple practice of just sitting. A key concept that is made quite clear in Bendawa is the union of practice and enlightenment. They are inseparable. And this, to me, is how Dogen squares his previous conundrum of original enlightenment. After all, what's the use of practice if we're all Buddhas to begin with? It's simple. Buddha's practice. Zazen is the practice of Buddhas. Zazen is the expression of Buddha Dharma, is the expression of enlightenment, the expression of our entire life, lives, future and past. All lives, all beings, sentient and insentient. It is how we naturally express the Dharma, just like mountains and streams naturally expressing Dharma, without effort. And the effects of our practice in enlightenment, our Zazen, whether we are sitting, lying down, standing, or walking, go way beyond our perception. We can't see it. We can't touch it, or hear it, or even think about it, or for sure fully understand it. And forget about the effects of Zazen. Even fully apprehending the reality of our Zazen as it is unfolding is beyond our perception and the comprehending of our perception. I'll go into this a little bit more. Lately, though, I have to admit to you, my Zazen has been anything but still. I'm retired, retired ophthalmologist from an active medical practice, and you'd think that I'd have nothing but pleasant thoughts about flowers and butterflies and taking naps and so forth. Even if I didn't have any bodily aches and pains, which I do have, and they occasionally encroach and pester my Zazen mind, I still have a mind that seems to be devoted to planning. I'm a great planner. What book do I read next? What type of volunteer work should I be doing? What to cook? What to fix around the house? But I think that Dogen is trying to tell me that even with all that, despite that, no, because of that, I'm sitting with the entire universe of Buddhas and ancestors and beings of all kinds, creating and destroying time and space, all while practicing complete, perfect enlightenment. Yes, I imagine he would say, it's all there. It's a complete practice. You just don't see it or perceive it, but it's all there. Don't underestimate what you are doing, Neil. Just trust it. And when I let the thoughts come and go, not get caught up in them or blaming myself about the process of producing the thoughts. After all, maybe I'm not the one producing my thoughts. There are an awful lot of causes and conditions that are most likely what is driving my thoughts. Anyway, I digress. When I trust in my decision to make time for Zazen and really devote my life to Zazen, there is no more good or bad Zazen. It's just Zazen. Why worry? Just trust. The latter section of Bendowa is a written dialogue with 18 questions and answers about Zazen. In one of the answers, Dogen talks about the origin of the word Zen and the Zen school. The word Zen comes from Chan in Chinese, which is then also a transliteration of the Sanskrit word jhana, which means concentration or concentrated meditation. Dogen writes that Chan began when Bodhidharma went from India to China in the 6th century CE, sat in Zazen facing the wall at Shaolin Temple for 9 years in deep concentration. According to lore, lay people started calling his followers eventually the Zazen school, because he said an awful lot of Zazen. And this was later shortened to Zen. He urges us to know that the practice of Zazen is the complete path of Buddha Dharma, and nothing can be compared to it. So, the practice of Zazen is Zen. Zen is the practice of Zazen, which contains all of Buddhism. The second part of the first section of Bendowa has been extracted and titled Jijuyu Zamai, which means the self-fulfillment samadhi or self-receiving and employing samadhi. Doesn't matter, don't worry about it. But it's chanted at Soto Zen monasteries, including San Francisco Zen Center. And with your indulgence, I was hoping we could chant it here right now. So I printed out some copies. I hope I have enough. And if you can pass those around, thank you. Self-receiving and employing samadhi. Now all ancestors and all Buddhas who uphold Buddha Dharma have made it the true path of enlightenment to sit upright, practicing in the midst of self-fulfilling samadhi. Those who attained enlightenment in India and China followed this way. It was done so because teachers and disciples personally transmitted this excellent method as the essence of the teaching.
In the authentic tradition of our teaching, it is said that this directly transmitted, straightforward Buddha Dharma is the unsurpassable of the unsurpassable. From the first time you meet a master, without engaging in incense offering, bowing, chanting Buddha's name, repentance, or reading scriptures, you should just wholeheartedly sit and thus drop away body and mind. When even for a moment you express the Buddha's seal in the three actions by sitting upright in samadhi, the whole phenomenal world becomes the Buddha's seal, and the entire sky turns into enlightenment. Because of this, all Buddha Tathagatas, as the original source, increase their Dharma bliss and renew their magnificence in the awakening of the way. Furthermore, all beings in the 10 directions and the 6 realms, including the 3 lower realms, at once obtain pure body and mind, realize the state of great emancipation, and manifest the original face. At this time, all things realize correct awakening. Myriad objects partake of the Buddha body, and sitting upright under the Bodhi tree, you immediately leap beyond the boundary of awakening. At this moment, you turn the unsurpassably great Dharma wheel and found profound wisdom, ultimate and unconditioned. Because such broad awakening resonates back to you and helps you inconceivably, you will in zazen unmistakably drop away body and mind, cutting off the various defiled thoughts from the past, and realize essential Buddha Dharma. Thus you will raise up Buddha activity at innumerable practice places of Buddha everywhere, cause everyone to have the opportunity of ongoing Buddhahood, and vigorously uplift the ongoing Buddha Dharma. Because earth, grass, trees, walls, tiles, and pebbles all engage in Buddha activity, those who receive the benefit of wind and water caused by them are inconceivably helped by the Buddha's guidance, splendid and unthinkable, and awaken intimately to themselves. Those who receive these water and fire benefits spread the Buddha's guidance awakening. Because of this, all those who live with you and speak with you will obtain endless Buddha virtue, and will unroll widely inside and outside of the entire universe the endless, unremitting, unthinkable, unnameable Buddha Dharma. All this, however, does not appear within perception. Because it is unconstructedness and stillness, it is immediate realization. If practice and realization were two things, as it appears to an ordinary person, each could be recognized separately. But what can be met with recognition is not realization itself, because realization is not reached by a deluded mind. In stillness, mind and object merge in realization and go beyond enlightenment. Nevertheless, because you are in the state of fulfilling samadhi without disturbing its quality, moving a particle, you extend the Buddha's great activity, the incomparably profound and subtle teaching. Grass, trees, and lands which are embraced by this teaching together radiate a great light and endlessly expound the inconceivable profound Dharma. Grass, trees, and walls bring forth a teaching for all beings, common people as well as sages, and they in accord extend this Dharma for the sake of grass, trees, and walls, thus the realm of self-awakening and awakening others variably holds the mark of realization with nothing lacking in realization. Self is manifested without ceasing for a moment. This being so, the Zazen of even one person at one moment imperceptibly accords with all things and fully resonates through all time. Thus, in the past, future, and present of the limitless universe, this Zazen carries on the Buddha's teaching endlessly. Each moment of Zazen is equally wholeness of practice, equally wholeness of realization. This is not only practice while sitting, it is like a hammer striking emptiness. Before and after, its exquisite peel permeates everywhere. How can it be limited to this moment? Hundreds of things all manifest original practice from the original face. It is impossible to measure. Know that even Buddhas of the 10 directions, as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, exert their strength, and with the Buddha's wisdom try to measure the merit of one person's Zazen, they will not be able to fully comprehend it.
I really love that chant. It literally blows my mind every time I read that. When even for a moment you express the Buddha's seal in the three actions by sitting upright in samadhi, the whole phenomenal world becomes the Buddha's seal. And the entire sky turns into enlightenment. Isn't that marvelous? The endless, cosmic, beneficial, karmic effects from just sitting. Or you could say, the cosmic, non-karmic effects of just sitting. Why non-karmic effects? It's a lot easier to keep the precepts when we're just sitting. Even though we can't, right? Even though we can't sense the full reality and karmic effects of just sitting, we know what we're not doing. Not getting in the way of other people. We're not tearing anyone or anything down. There's no destruction. We're leaving no trace, except maybe for the breath. All of this, however, does not appear within perception, Dogen writes. There is so much that is going on that is beyond our perception. You believe that? Yes. Yes. So I have been interested in perception and the senses, in particular the visual sense, for quite some time. I've worked for decades as a cataract surgeon in the endeavor to improve people's vision. All that we know as sentient beings, all of reality, presents itself through our senses. And this includes our thoughts. And we'd like to think that with mindfulness and awareness, we can sharpen our perceptions of these sensory inputs and get closer to understanding true reality. I think Dogen would say, though, that this is a delusion. There are so many external phenomena that we miss. If you've ever seen the video of someone dribbling a ball in a group of people, while someone else dressed as a gorilla walks through the middle of the crowd unnoticed by the viewer of the video?
Yeah.
You can Google that. Check it out on the online. Or the experiment of a person at a counter being helped to fill out a form. At a certain point in the controlled experiment, the helper ducks down behind the counter, seemingly to get something, and a completely different person pops up and continues to help the other person to fill the form out. In over two-thirds of the time, the subjects never noticed the switch. And the two people were, you know, completely different people, different color hair, different outfits. It's a phenomenon called change blindness. So our sensory apparatus is extremely limited. If you've read Ed Yung's book, An Immense World, he shows that other animal species are shown to have sensations that go far beyond human capability. And yet all animals have sensory blind spots of their own. Donald Hoffman, in his fascinating book, The Case Against Reality, Why Evolution Hid the Truth from Our Eyes, he reasons that living beings have evolved to have sensory inputs that operate in certain ways to enhance evolutionary fitness. This makes a lot of sense to me. It helps us to survive and procreate. Hoffman is a cognitive scientist and a psychologist who has done research in artificial intelligence, vision science, perception, and consciousness. In his book, he notes that the biologist Jacob van Uschkull recognized that because sense organs differ between species, there are differences in sensory perceptions between species as well, which he calls Umfelds. If this is the case, which species have truer perceptions of our surroundings? But is what we see or think actually what is really there? If so, this assumes that the universe is made up of real objects that are mind independent, right? With this assumption, if I see a tomato on my kitchen counter and I look away, the tomato itself does not change. It's independent of my mind. It's the same tomato object in all of its three dimensions, when I'm looking at it or not looking at it. This is physical realism, or as Donald Hoffman puts it, metaphysical realism. Do you know all about this? Is this like your line? Okay. Let me know later if I've really messed this up.
No, no, you're doing great.
Okay. There is a real world that conforms to three-dimensional space and time out there. This is metaphysical realism. That our perceptions are evolving to better understand. And this confers a competitive advantage to the species. Now, in the 1990s, Hoffman wrote to Francis Crick, Watson and Crick, concerning the nature of reality and our perceptions. They were both members of the Helmholtz Club at UC Irvine, which explored how advances in neuroscience could explain the basis of consciousness. Hoffman asked Crick the question about the tomato sitting on the counter. If you observe an object and then look away, is the object still there? Does it still exist? Crick replies, surely the sun existed before there was anyone to perceive it. Seeing is an active, constructive process. and that what we see is a symbolic interpretation of the world, but in fact, we have no direct knowledge of objects in the world. Seeing is believing your best theory, then. Crick went on to say that, following Immanuel Kant, one has to distinguish between the thing in itself, the sun in the above example, and the idea of the thing, which is what our brains construct. What are perceived are symbolic constructions. The idea of the sun does not exist prior to its mental construction, but the sun in itself did. So that was Francis Crick's understanding. Okay, so back to the tomato sitting on the counter. When we look at the tomato, we see that it's red. Where it is in space, we identify it as a tomato, as something that is not harmful, and in fact, something that is good to eat. That's what our evolution has taught us. When we look away, the metaphysical realism school concludes that the tomato is still there exactly as we experienced it when we observed it. In the example of a tree falling in the forest, the tree exists, whether or not there is someone nearby to hear it fall. Now, Hoffman's research mentor, David Marr, who revolutionized the understanding of vision in the late 1970s and early 1980s, also had the view that our perceptions normally match reality and that our ideas of things correctly describes the things in themselves. So in other words, the better we are at perceiving, at being aware of our senses, our perceptions, the closer we will get to understanding true reality. But the evolutionary theorist Robert Trivers makes a similar argument. He says, our sense organs have evolved to give us a marvelously detailed and accurate view of the outside world. Our sensory systems are organized to give us a detailed and accurate view of reality, exactly as we would expect if the truth about the outside world helps us to navigate it more effectively. In other words, he's saying the same thing. Our sensory perceptions are organized to help us understand the true world around us. So all of these people tend to share the same idea that our perceptions, as we evolve, may be getting closer to understanding true reality, things in themselves. Okay, but here's where we take off a little bit. Hoffman has a different idea. He says our perceptions fall short and not only underestimate the true reality of the tomato and everything else, but our senses and our sensory perception cannot appreciate any aspect of the tomato that is true or real, and that extends also to all of objective reality. So perceptions cannot appreciate any aspect of the tomato or true reality. His thesis is that our sensory system and perceptions, yes, they have evolved to increase our evolutionary fitness to survive and procreate, focusing in our perceptions to do things that help us in our fitness. And he uses evolutionary game theory to back this up. But that's where our sensory perceptions end. A useful way to think about the difference between what we perceive and objective reality is what Hoffman calls the interface theory of perception. When we use our computer or our iPad or any device with a screen, we see little icons that we can click on. Let's say it's an icon of an email message. The icon itself is composed of pixels of light. Strike our eye. It represents an email message, but it is not the real message itself. The icon is simply a representation of the functions of current, resistance, and capacitance. The interface that allows me to do things like communicate with my friends and order a new filter for my furnace and such, but it's not the thing in itself. The icon is not the email. The email itself is a construct. It is an electronic virtual version of a letter, for example. Even if I were to write a physical letter using pen on paper and send it by snail mail, how quaint. The letter is ink and paper. The ink and paper are not the sentiments that I feel when I think about my friend as I write the letter. The letter is a model. It's a construct. Hoffman concludes his book showing that space and time, which are also human constructs, do not underlie objective reality. He says consciousness does. Hoffman discounts the theory that consciousness can be found by examining the anatomy and physiology of the brain. Current research using functional MRIs and EEGs and PET scans can give us an idea of which brain regions are involved in certain brain functions, but it cannot tell us where the seat of consciousness lies, where the individual mind rests. How can a bunch of neurons, which don't appear to have consciousness, generate consciousness? Well, Hoffman's buddy, Francis Crick, who held the belief that consciousness can be identified and replicated from an assembly of nerve cells, calls this the astonishing hypothesis. It's where a bunch of electrons, neurons, somehow form a consciousness. Astonishingly. But Hoffman has a different idea. His view is not that of metaphysical realism, but conscious realism. He says the fundamental elements of our universe, of all reality, are not subatomic matter bits or energy packets, but are rather conscious bits, which coalesce to form conscious agents, a human, for example, or a computer. All of reality is consciousness. And I think this is what ties my good friend, through his book, Donald Hoffman, with Dogen. And this is what they share. All of reality is consciousness. All of reality is mind. Reality is zazen. Zazen is reality. When we sit zazen, we go beyond space and time, beyond sensation and perception, and we reside in consciousness. We reside in big mind, as Suzuki Roshi put it. Little mind thoughts come and go, and yet somehow, in some way, we approach, perhaps asymptotically, ultimate reality. Things as they are across liminal space. Ultimate reality. We don't have the sensory apparatus to sense it or understand it. But if we continue on this path, continue with our zazen, we know that we are a part of it, integral to it. And Dogen's words are then confirmed. When even for a moment you express the Buddha's seal in the three actions by sitting upright in samadhi, the whole phenomenal world becomes the Buddha's seal, and the entire sky turns into enlightenment. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for listening.
What you were saying about the gorilla and the people who are playing basketball, and you don't notice it in this whole thing about objective reality and subjective reality and perception and reality and the friction that it causes and, you know, the in-between.
Yeah.
The friction that happens, it causes become friction. Because when we come up against objective reality and perceptions, like, oh, this is not what I thought it was. So, simply put, all of zazen and being on this path is about waking up. The consciousness is nothing else but just waking up.
Yes.
Waking up, constantly. Mm-hmm. And you use the word jhana.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting to use the word jhana because jhana in Hindi means going.
Mm.
And jhana is also a term of endearment that is used within families towards children.
Mm.
You know, when they're called, jhana, you know, it's like it's a term of endearment, something that is beyond the beloved.
Mm.
So it's very intimate. It's a very intimate word to be used in that. And it's interesting, the Zen is based on that, something that is that intimate, the intimacy that you have with your own children. So, I just wanted to share
that. That's lovely.
Yeah.
And the intimacy we have both with ourselves and the entire universe at the same time while sitting in zazen in an intimate way. I think that's wonderful.
Jhan actually comes from life.
Mm.
Jhan means life.
Mm.
The source or life or the life force. So, you know, giving your children, you know, the name jhana and the pet name is like calling them a form of life force. So that's really interesting. I'm like, this is really interesting. It also means going, you know.
Coming and going.
Yeah. Thank you.
Tathagata. Thank you.
Coming from Vajrayana practice, I noticed something that doesn't exist in Mahayana, which is the separation of thoughts and speech from body and mind. It's not dualism. It's body, speech, and mind. And when you said thought is part of a sensory input, I immediately like, which organ perceives thought from where? And then you said consciousness is everything, which goes back to a different school from Taiwan that says there is a information field, just like there's gravitational field and electromagnetic field. There's a three-dimensional information field that we perceive thoughts from. So His Holiness Dalai Lama gifted me a book that he signed that in the book that says phenomena has three types, form, which is material, which is color and shape, formless, which is consciousness and knowledge, which means Vajrayana treat consciousness as information. I think Buddha goes there when he reaches Nirvana. And then the third one is abstract, which is space and time, which contains those two phenomena. So Just wanted to share that. It's very thought-provoking.
Wonderful. Yeah, I spent some months just sitting with the five skandhas, form, sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness. Form, sensation, perception, formation, volitional, getting up and doing based upon your sensations and perceptions. The five skandhas, the Sanskrit word is skanda. And thought is an interesting thing because it touches upon many of the skandhas. And so, for example, one of the skandhas is sensations. And we typically think of the five senses, right? And in Buddhism, as I learned many years ago, the sixth sense is thought. That's the sixth sense. That's a good question. I don't have an answer for you.
So the answer is from the Taiwan Sichuanese Research and Information Field.
That's certainly, I fully validate that. I think
it's
that is
you.
That
it's
is true. That is a possibility. And each of the senses has a consciousness.
Every single cell has consciousness. Consciousness
yes.
is information. It's a projection of every single atom in the information, three-dimensional space of information. That's why everything's conscious. It's
yeah.
a full cycle.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, I've taken your talk, Umar's question, and your question, all is one big koan.
Uh-huh.
And
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
Without getting into too much detail for this particular context, you know, I'm going to take a stab at it. What this all indicates to me is that several koans are all aspects of the same one. In particular, tree falling in the forest, seeing sound, sound of one hand,
mm-hmm.
an original face, and Joshu's Mu, case one of Mumonkan.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about
fact,
that.
With all afternoon. Of those put together, all true koans are in fact one koan. And to crack it, we need to move beyond ideas of objective and subjective reality.
Yes.
Thinking in terms of that is wrong because there is no objective reality out there,
mm-hmm.
and there is no subjective reality in here.
Mm-hmm.
At the risk of sounding totally postmodern, one needs to think in terms of the non-dualism of intersubjectivity and no objective reality. Those are two aspects of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So objective reality is not the thing itself. It's not the noumenon.
Mm-hmm.
To grasp the noumenon, one needs to completely abandon ideas of objective reality,
mm-hmm.
of phenomena.
Yes. Yes. I mean, you know, that's a practice that I love to do when I'm sitting zazen. Is, for example, when I hear sounds and my mind instantly wants to name the sound, because that's what the brain is trained to do. We've evolved to do that, to protect ourselves, I think. And I work with that a bit. And to try and disengage the mind perceiving and just let the sound come and go, then subjectiveness and objectivity also dissolve. So yes, and all koans, I think, share this.
The double slit experiment, mm-hmm. have the answer though. Like tree and tomatoes are a bad example, but light don't exist until someone observes it. Well, light is a cloud of probability. The shorthand's cat is both live and dead until somebody sees it.
Check out the koan Onami or Great Waves. And there's another koan in Mumonkan about a girl who's sick. And there's one at home who's sick, and there's another one out at the market at the same time. And later on, they merge the same girl. Which one is the same, the true one?
The universe renders itself when somebody looks at it. Quantum physics have experimented. It's not a theory anymore. Mm-hmm. It's an experiment. When you observe a proton, it goes back in time to change its past. Mm-hmm. That's why they say the future determines
but
the
remember,
past.
Everything that we observe as scientists or not is filtered through our mind.
This is experimentation.
Even experimentation.
Have you seen the experiment, the latest double slit?
Well, I think you're talking about, and I forget, I was just talking to somebody this weekend, and there's the physics word for that, the quantum phenomenon of the electron that is spinning both ways at the same time or in two locations at the same time.
Quantum entanglement. That's
entanglement. Or they go through both slits at the same time.
Now, don't think of particles as real entities.
Yeah. So what my point is all of these are experiments that are performed, that are designed and performed and observed by humans, and so there's always going to be a bias and an interpretation based upon our current evolutionary stage that we're in. It's always going to be limited.
Matches the Zen koan.
Okay.
It's coherent. The result is
yes.
Very Buddhist.
Yes.
Yeah.
We don't know. Don't know. Go on. Don't know. Exactly. Let me. Hi.
Yeah, okay.
How are you, May?
And then also beginner's mind also talk about this practice is beyond consciousness. You know,
yes.
Beyond consciousness. So my question is, consciousness is one or zero?
It's wave.
Yeah, it's none of those. We can't put a finger on consciousness and say it's that. Right? Can you? There are a lot of people out there trying to say that consciousness is this. Oh, this path in the brain or this particular algorithm or whatever is consciousness.
Consciousness is like knowledge. It's formless phenomena. It's
I don't think it's my view, it's not knowledge.
Consciousness is not dependent on phenomena.
Yes.
Consciousness
yes.
is a type of formless phenomenon according to Vajrayana practice.
Well, and I respect Vajrayana practice.
But is consciousness artificial?
You think consciousness is artificial? Intelligence. Yeah, so I had a feeling somebody was going to bring that up. And I think the point, though, isn't is it conscious or is it not conscious? Is it sentience or it's not sentience? It's the wrong question. The question is, what is consciousness? And, my understanding, just from reading Bendawa and just, sitting in Zazen, is consciousness is vast. And it is mountains and waters, and it is tiles and pebbles and grasses and trees and AI. It's all those things.
Information.
It's...
What is information?
Information doesn't objectively exist either.
Information is a projection of every material thing. It's parallel to each other. It's the yin of the yang that you don't see.
Did anybody have a question online? Okay. It's good to see you.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's time to chant.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.